This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With our new president taking office on Saturday, politics is on our minds. My guest Bill Bradley reflects on American politics in his recent book, The Journey from Here. Not too long ago, Bradley hoped to be the next president. He ran in the Democratic primary. He represented New Jersey in the U.S. Senate from 1979 to 97. Before entering politics, he was a basketball star, playing with the New York Knicks from 1967 to 77. In 1982, Bradley was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame. As we look ahead to the inauguration, I'm wondering if you're watching and thinking, it could have been me, or I wish it was me.
Well, in a way, yes, but I think that that passed during the course of the campaign itself. I think that there's only one reason to run for president of the United States, and that is that you think that your leadership is what the country needs at that particular time in its history. That's why I ran. The people in the Democratic Party decided that that was not to be me to have that chance. And so I think you adapt, you accept, and you move on.
You know, in this inaugural week, I have a real question for you, which is, and you've partly answered it, but I want to hear more. Why would anyone in their right mind want to be president? Now, not that anyone's asking me to be president, but I know, you know, I can't imagine having that kind of responsibility, the burdens of the country and the world on your shoulders.
Well, I think that, as I said, there's only one reason to want to be president of the United States, and that is because you think that your leadership at this particular time in our nation's history can improve the quality of life for millions of Americans. I think that that is by far the main reason to run. I suppose people run for other reasons, some obvious, some less obvious, some deep in their psyche, some more clear to the observer, relating to power, relating to their own unresolved issues. But I think that the real question is, for me, was the only reason to do this, because it is a tremendous sacrifice. You're essentially giving your life up for your country, is because you think your leadership will make a difference in the lives of people, and it's a form of service, and it's the ultimate service and the ultimate dedication to your country.
When you withdrew from the primary, was there at least a part of you that was relieved to be getting out?
Well, no, I would say I was not relieved to be getting out, because I wanted to be president. I wanted to enact an agenda that meant a lot to me, that I thought the country needed in terms of health care and education, the environment and race, etc. And so getting out was the loss of the opportunity to do that. The president has the bully pulpit, is the only leader in the country. I mean, no other politician is really known, because the TV is in the president's face every day. And so people get a chance to really know him. And that means that he has a chance to shape their view of themselves as well as the country. So I was disappointed not to have that chance. On the liberation side, I suppose a part of me was glad to get back in a car and drive on the highways at my own speed. I mean, that's how I relax. And when you're in a campaign, you can't really do that because of the Secret Service.
Let's talk about negative politics. When you started your primary campaign, you said you hoped to run a completely positive campaign. Didn't work out that way. Do you think it's possible to run a completely positive campaign?
What I said was I wanted to, the premise of my campaign was to go out and tell people what you really believe and win. And it proved that I didn't win. There were probably reasons other than that. But that one of the factors is that in the course of the campaign, if you do not respond to negative attacks on you, you essentially allow people to define you by the negative attacks. And that is an experience that I had in the course of the campaign that I think discouraged me from believing that you can run just a positive campaign and win. That's what I tried to do. And I was hurt by doing that. In fact, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, you should have struck back harder, sooner, longer, more intensely. They wanted the fight. They wanted the negative response to the negative attack. And
actually, I heard criticisms on both sides. Some people said, you said you'd stick to the high road, you should have stayed there. And other people said, you should have fought back harder and swifter and sooner.
That's the catch-22, isn't it? I mean, everyone wants you to be the experiment. And the reality is that when I decided to respond aggressively, let's say after Iowa, which I had lost. And I refused to go negative in Iowa, and I lost. When I went to New Hampshire, I actually took some very pointed criticisms of my opponent, and in a week I went from 18 points behind to 4 points behind, narrowly losing the race. And so I think that, you know, you have to, it's not easy to say, but I think that you have to be clear about what you believe and decide you're going to run a campaign that way. And when you do attack, not attack on the basis of ad hominem attacks, but on the basis of a record.
Well, among the things you said about Al Gore was that he was using scare tactics in the way he described your health care policy, and that you also accused Gore of meanness in politics. I'm wondering during a primary if it's in back of your mind, well, if I say negative things about the other Democratic candidate now, will that be used against the party in the latter part of the campaign?
Sure. That's always in the back of your mind because you're first of all a Democrat and you want to win the race. So, yeah, that was in the back of my mind.
But you live with that?
Well, you ultimately temper what you say so that you try to be direct, but at the same time, you don't go so far overboard in one direction that you might actually end up helping the other party.
What about the whole, like, charisma issue? I mean, one of the things that you were criticized for by some people in the press was sometimes giving dull speeches. And, you know, charisma is such the thing now in politics.
Well, I mean, charisma would make a difference if they carried your whole speech, but they don't carry your whole speech. They only carry a bite, sound bite of the speech. And then there's a judgment that, A, you're this or that. And I found that, you know, when I was in rooms of 50, 100, 400 people, that I could talk to them, and I felt that, you know, I was reaching them. I could see their eyes. In the book, I talk about, you know, speaking to a group of people and seeing a connection in their eyes and seeing these as people who were identified with me and wanting to knit them together into a broader stream of idealism in the country. And the challenge, I saw that happening when I spoke. I was not deceived by that. A lot of people didn't see that. I did. And I think that the key thing here is that there is an inherent limitation. And charisma is really what the press says it is. It's not, that doesn't exist in the mind of a lot of people. People listen to you. They respond to you. And they respond to a lot of things. I mean, you can be flamboyant or you can be sincere. And in some cases, sincerity beats flamboyance.
We're looking at American politics with former senator, former presidential candidate, and former Knicks star Bill Bradley. His latest book is called The Journey from Here. You served in the Senate from 1978 to 1996. What are some of the greatest changes you've seen in congressional politics from the time when you started in politics?
Well, it used to be that you were elected in a campaign, hard fought. There was a winner and a loser. If you were the winner, you went to the Senate. You became a senator. And then, you know, maybe 18 months, max 2 years before your next election, you started in the candidate mode again. Now, the electioneering never stops. Amendments are offered from the floor of the Senate that are not substantive amendments, but are political amendments meant to get people on the record so somebody can run a negative commercial about that person. There are strategies that are primarily devised by interest groups as opposed to senators and their staffs that are aimed at essentially improving the chances of the interest group to raise money and to polarize as opposed to legislate. And I think that those changes are detrimental. Money's a big difference. I mean, you know, I remember my first campaign for the United States Senate in New Jersey. I raised about $1.2 million or $1.3 million. The person who won the Senate race in New Jersey this year spent $60 million of his own money. That's different. And if you are a politician, you're spending all your time raising money. You're not spending time doing the work that the people sent you to Washington to do. And because more and more money is needed to run these campaigns, that's a big difference than when I came into the Senate in 1978.
What about the style of discourse in Congress? Do you think that's changed?
Well, it's become less a place where people make speeches and more a place where people speak sound bites. And there are still speeches made on the Senate floor, but it is not the same as it was on an evening in a heated debate when Russell Long of Louisiana would take the floor and wax eloquent and funny and threatening to, the assembled senators. Now it is much more a matter of fewer bipartisan coalitions and more lining people up in your party and having two sides go to war. For example, there were a lot of bills in my first term in the Senate, and there were bills in my second term in the Senate, where you put together a bipartisan coalition. You might have a regional coalition. You might have the upper Midwest and the Northeast that would be against the South and the Southwest. You might have the far West and the East against the Midwest. Or there could be a lot of different regional coalitions. And then you found a lot of people who were essentially common sense legislators, and they would occasionally buck their party. And they would do so on a somewhat regular basis. And that meant that there were always a floating number of votes, 15 or 20, that if you were a serious legislator, you could put together. And if you worked with them on both sides of the aisle, you had a chance to get something done. Now it's primarily two leaders negotiating a deal before anything happens and then just simply playing out the deal.
My guest is Bill Bradley. His latest book is called The Journey From Here. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Bradley, and we're talking about the state of American politics. He's a former senator, former presidential candidate, and former star of the Knicks. What role would you like to see President Clinton play after he leaves the White House? What role would you like to see him play within the party?
I'd like to see him have a lot of time for reflection and write his memoirs. I think that that's the best thing that he could do.
Why?
Because I think that he could have something to say that the country would benefit from. I think his role in the party is going to be determined really by the dynamic of the next couple of years. I think that I don't think there's ever been a president who's retired and essentially sought to play a role in the party. Now, maybe he will. I mean, certainly I wouldn't put it past him for trying to do that. And I think some people will want him to do that. And it'll focus on...
It sounds like you don't want him to do that.
Well, I think that he ought to take a little time off, that's what I think, and write his memoirs. He can always come back. But I think that, if anyone should play the role of the leader of the party, it's the person who was nominated by the party, which is Al Gore. And I think that that is, unfortunately... difficult to do if you have a president who seeks to do that himself, a former president. So I question whether in the long run it'll be that helpful for the party. But I think he's a man of great talent, and he has deep conviction about some issues, and he likes the fray. And so I don't know what ultimately he'll end up doing.
What role would you like to see Al Gore play in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think that he is the person who was the nominee, and I think that he should be given a certain right to be heard and a right to lead the party in when they're in opposition.
Now, it's interesting to hear you say that about him since he was your opponent.
Well, but I lost to him, and, to the victor goes the spoils, and part of the spoils is appointing, is taking over that role. I mean, certainly I'll try to have my voice heard. But I think ultimately, for example, the head of the Democratic National Committee, I think that Al Gore should have had as great a voice as President Clinton in who that person would be. And I think that, to me, that's a good way to proceed.
How do you see the Clinton legacy, for better or for worse?
Oh, I think that... there will be some things that people look back and say he did very well. The budget agreement in 1993 that really set the stage for the balanced budget. The NAFTA agreement, the World Trade Organization agreement, and the most favored nation status for China all kept America engaged in the world, kept pushing open trade further, kept acknowledging the extent to which our future is inextricably entwined with the rest of the world. I think those are things that you can look at and say, you know, those were significant accomplishments. I think you can look on the other side and say that, there were issues that he didn't handle well. I don't think that Russia was particularly a distinguished accomplishment. To the contrary, I think that we've lost a decade with Russia. You can look at some of the things that he did, for example, in terms of welfare reform, which when it passed was basically a Republican bill in which people supported with his urging, risking a bill that was destructive ultimately to children. Now, he ameliorated that with future actions, but the original bill was one that was difficult to take. And then I think that people will look back and see a man of enormous talent, great talent, with a very large ambition for himself and for the country, and find that it was squandered from time to time by his other failings. And I think that will be the judgment of history. I think that the most significant accomplishment, of course, will be the booming economy of this period and his attempt to redefine the Democratic Party as a party of the center and to take small steps as opposed to big steps. Now, that's not always good, in my opinion, if you're a leader.
What are you going to be doing on Inauguration Day?
You know, I haven't thought about it. I'll probably be working. I mean, I'll probably tune in and listen to George W. Bush's inauguration speech because I'm, you know, a political speaker. I like to hear what he's going to say, how he's going to say it. Other than that, I'll be getting up with my family and going to work and having a full day.
Do you feel that his legitimacy as president is at all compromised by what went on during the Florida aftermath?
Well, I think that there are a number of things. First, I think that ultimately the Supreme Court made the decision, not the people. And that is a precedent that is somewhat ominous. But what struck me was after the decision was made, how quickly people came behind. And I think that Al Gore's concession speech went some direction toward ending the conflict because he, I thought, was very gracious and made the point very well. And so I think that Bush is accepted as the president now. Now, this could be like 1824. 1824, John Quincy Adams beat Andrew Jackson in a disputed election that went to the House of Representatives. So it went even further than to the Supreme Court. Or at least it took a different direction because it ended up in the House of Representatives. And, of course, that was the beginning of the movement that 4 years later culminated in Andrew Jackson being elected President of the United States. So the real question is how Democrats handle this. And my hope is that Democrats will cooperate and try to get an agenda passed but start to build toward 2004 when we'll have a chance to demonstrate that we actually got more votes in 2000, but we're going to get more votes in 2004 in the right states.
Bill Bradley, I have one last question for you that has nothing to do with politics. And this is something that you write about a little bit in your latest book. You said that your father was disabled and that he suffered from calcified arthritis of the lower spine. He lived in constant pain. He couldn't walk more than a couple of blocks. Your mother had to dress him every morning. You became an athlete. I mean, you had glory in your body. And I'm wondering if you thought a lot about your father's imprisonment in your body during your years as a basketball star.
You know, the biggest thing about my father's circumstance was that how much I considered it just who my father was. I mean, there was no concept of disability in those years when I was growing up, and he never complained. And it was just who he was. It's true. I never saw him tie his shoes or drive a car or throw a ball or walk further than a couple of blocks. And my mother did help dress him in the morning, and I'd fix his suspenders and pick up the paper from the steps in the morning. But I never thought of my father then. So when I think of disability today, I think of all those Americans who we consider disabled, who have the same spirit and determination as my father, and who puts the onus on us to view them as Americans, as human beings who have different attributes than we do, and but who can make as large a contribution. So I never thought of my father's disability in a sense when I was playing basketball. I guess, well, I'll take that back. Maybe I thought how lucky I was to be able to run and jump and shoot and have my body carry me forward in ways that I never saw my father able to do. So if anything, that experience created a little humility in me and also a deep sense of appreciation for good health.
Bill Bradley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Bradley's latest book is called The Journey From Here. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.